Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
On July 19th, 1977, the world teacher, the Christ Maitreya, head of the spiritual hierarchy, emerged from his ancient retreat and is now in the modern world. With his disciples, the Masters of the Wisdom, he will inaugurate the new age of synthesis and brotherhood.
Good morning and welcome to our World Teacher program on Wellington's Access Radio 106.1 FM. Presented by Teresa and David on behalf of Share International New Zealand.
The work of Charles Eisenstein will be familiar to readers of Share International, as we have published a number of articles by him. His book, Climate, A New Story, was released in September 2018. Even the title issues a challenge to current thinking and indicates that we may need to widen the lens setting and see the bigger picture in our search for solutions.
Felicity Elliott interviewed him for Share International. Part one of the transcript was featured in the January-February 2019 double edition of the magazine and part two in the May edition. The following is an abbreviated version due to time restrictions. Felicity Elliott begins by asking Charles,
"You have a new book just out. Its title is Climate, A New Story. Would you please say something about it?"
Charles replies, "I always feel a moment of hesitation when I describe the book and what it's about, because the issue is already so thoroughly worked that when people hear the title, they tend to think they know what I'm going to say. And what I am saying will be unfamiliar to a lot of readers, because I'm calling for a major paradigm shift in the way that we engage with the climate issue. Even to the point of asking, is climate even the right framing for the eco-crisis that is unfolding in the world?"
My book advances the living planet view, which is in contradistinction to the geomechanical view of climate. We have to look at our planet as a living organism, and when we do that, in order to maintain its resilience and vitality, the most important thing is to maintain the integrity of its organs.
And what are the organs of this living being? Well, they are forests, wetlands, the soil, biodiversity, species, every ecosystem, the apex predators, the fish, the whales, the corals, the seagrass meadows, the mangroves, all these kinds of things. What I learned in my research was that even if we cut emissions to zero overnight, if we continue to degrade these living parts of a living being, then the biosphere will continue to spiral out of control.
If we continue to degrade the systems that maintain its living integrity, then we'll experience climate derangement. It might not even be global warming, it might be global cooling. Or it might be an average temperature that stays relatively constant but masks horrible fluctuations in temperature and precipitation. It could lead to climate chaos.
While this debate has been going on, huge areas of rainforest have been destroyed. The rainforests of Borneo have been almost completely destroyed. Current climate models tend to minimize or ignore or unable to account for the effect of life on the climate.
A major thrust of the book is the living planet view. From this view, certain practices and policies become really important. The first priority has to be to protect every remaining bit of old growth forest and all other undamaged ecosystems. These are precious reservoirs of the vitality of the planet. It's beyond what science can explain as far as the maintenance of the hydrological cycle and the reservoir of biodiversity that exercise very subtle and mysterious functions on the planet.
We're barely beginning to understand, for example, the vast mycelial network which can span whole continents until they're cut off or interrupted by roads. This huge communication network ties together the planet, just like the nervous and endocrine systems bind us into a coherent human being. So, we need to protect and preserve all remaining pristine ecosystems. Secondly, we need to repair and regenerate damaged ecosystems, particularly farmland. There is an array of practices grouped in a category of regenerative farming.
I'd like to hark back to the original meaning of the word organic and organic agriculture. Why is it called organic? In chemistry, organic means carbon, carbon-containing compounds. And what is carbon? Carbon is what makes soil into a living being. All of the organic living molecules in the soil are carbon-based. If we want to restore livingness to the land that has been devastated by chemical monocrop agriculture, we need to focus on the soil.
There are all kinds of permaculture practices, regenerative grazing methods, agroforestry practices that are being developed by pioneers in many parts of the world, often sourcing them from traditional ways of farming. These methods have always taken care of the soil. That's a close second priority to preservation of pristine forests.
Felicity then says, "As I'm listening to you, I keep thinking about other dominant structures, like our economic and political systems, like our mindset and value systems. They have a very negative effect on the planet, the climate, and ecosystems. The profit motive drives much of the destruction of our environment. It looks as if all of the structures all have to change, and all at the same time, in order to make the urgent shift needed to restore and save our planet."
Charles replies, "Quite right. They do all need to change at the same time. You mentioned economics and politics. All of our systems are built around resource stripping, extraction and exploitation of the natural world, even down to the metaphysical level, where we see matter outside of ourselves as just a bunch of generic protons, neutrons, and electrons."
I like to look at the environmental crisis as a kind of initiation into a completely different relationship between humanity and the rest of life. I'd like to qualify that by saying what we're talking about is for modern civilized humanity. This is not new for humans historically. We have a very ancient relationship with Earth.
Felicity, I know from your work, and it's also our view too, that you are very aware of an alienation and separation at the basis of our current and dominant civilization.
Charles, and one aspect of that alienation is to see matter and all the rest of life as being less a full being, without the qualities of a self, without consciousness, intelligence, without desire or purpose or a destiny that it's moving towards fulfilling. Then, of course, we want to stamp our own design, intelligence and purpose onto it.
That story of the world underlies most of our systems, most particularly the economic system. Even if we have a change of consciousness and no longer want to live in a way which degrades the rest of life, our economic system nearly compels us to do that. I have a chapter in the book about that. I also wrote a book devoted to this called Sacred Economics, which is basically asking the question, what would a money system, an economic system, look like if it were aligned with co-creative service to all life?
Really, it comes down to claiming our purpose here, both as a species and as individuals. The climate crisis invites us to ask that question. Why are we here? The story of separation, the mythology that we've lived in, says that on one level it is just to survive. That is, we're programmed by our genes to maximize reproductive self-interest, etc., etc.
That's obsolete biology, but the idea is still around. It was also said that we're here to become the lords and masters of creation, to ascend above nature, to harness natural forces. Perhaps that was a guiding purpose for a certain stage of development, but that is no longer resonant for most people. So we have to ask ourselves, what is our purpose? And what kind of world do we want to be part of?
We can reclaim the word spiritual. A useful way to use the word is to see it in terms of the qualitative realm, that is, things that we can't measure. That distinguishes it from science, because science is fundamentally the study of what we can measure.
The idea that everything can be measured corresponds to a number is one of the foundational ideologies of science. It is a metaphysical, unprovable ideology. And we have expanded vastly our ability to measure, thinking that perhaps if we can minutely measure electrochemical states of the brain and body, we could even define love.
We're also attempting to translate environmental health into a data set. The simplest way to do that is what dominates the environmental discourse today, which is CO2 levels and temperature. To my mind, this is a violent reduction which leaves out so much of what planetary health is that we risk pursuing the lowering of this metric.
In other words, we are defining health by this metric while ignoring all of these other aspects of health that we don't know how to measure, or that we don't bother to measure, or that we can't measure. So everything we can't measure gets left out. And these are the things that come back to haunt us.
For instance, we realise that, actually the whales are important to the health of the ocean. All these things that seem to be unimportant, but we are beginning to see now, this is how life works. Everything is tied up with everything else, and it's hard to reduce that to a data set.
So, if we have a policy apparatus that prides itself on being data-driven, we'll end up leaving so much out. And especially, we'll leave out the kind of wisdom that comes from other ways of knowing beyond science and measurement. And these include what we might call spiritual ways of knowing, but also any kind of intimacy. People who have worked intimately with the land for generations have an understanding that sometimes is consistent with scientific understandings and sometimes isn't. I think we need to bring these other ways of knowing into our collective decision making.
When we take a holistic view, we understand that the way we treat the most vulnerable people in society is part and parcel of how we treat the most vulnerable being on earth. We see that the basic mindset of dismissing and othering and exploiting somebody applies to humans and to other beings. Then we can unify social and environmental activism and recognize that they're part of the same transition.
We can extend this attitude to the personal level, to relationships. For example, if I ignore my family in my campaign to save the world, then I'm creating a world which strengthens the field of ignoring what the heart calls to in favour of some big abstract ideal.
And if we embrace the causality of morphic resonance, which says that any change that happens in one place creates a field of change that makes the same change more easily happen elsewhere, so that any act of kindness generates a field of kindness, and so forth. You know, when I talk about the old story or the story of separation, part of that is an experience of life and mindset where everyone is out for themselves, so I'd better maximize my own security, my own power, my own control over the world, because this is not a friendly world. This is a hostile and at best an indifferent world where we're all separate and each person is in it for themselves.
Look what happens when you apply that mindset to, say, immigration or to geopolitics or to war. Pretty soon you are droning people, stripping their countries of resources, and then when they can't live there anymore and want to emigrate, then you build a wall and try to stop them. The whole thing is coming from this basic perception of separation.
So we can be walking anomalies to that old story. In every interaction, we can give people an experience that runs counter to that story, that says it is not a hostile universe. It is not true that everybody's in it for themselves. That says we're in this together, that the universe runs on love and generosity. I'll speak for myself here. Every time that I witness or experience generosity or unconditional love, then it relaxes me to do the same. And if enough of us do that, then the foundation of all the systems of separation begins to crumble.
You're listening to the World Teacher Program on Wellington's Access Radio, 106.1 FM. Felicity then says, in fact, they're already crumbling, aren't they? For so long, we've labelled as alternative this new way of thinking and being, and for decades, perhaps since the 1980s, it has been laughed at. But now it seems to be coming back, stronger than before, perhaps because the collapse of our ecological, political, and economic systems is so evident now.
Charles replies, yes, and the biggest danger for this movement, the rising of consciousness, is that it may get bribed and diverted into being more of the same, only in a new form. And the way that happens is through tempting you to find somebody to hate. So whereas in the past people might have directed their hate and separation at racial minorities, now it is towards white supremacists, or people who deny climate change, or the corporatocracy. Basically, what we're talking about is a war mentality.
Felicity, as you know, our name is Share International, with Share referring to the need, as we see it, to redistribute the world's resources, technology, scientific knowledge, the raw material, food, and so on. We also look at how this could be achieved. So it means looking at infrastructure, delivery systems from an international level to the very local aspects of the problems. We're talking about systemic change, which probably needs to be triggered by some kind of breakdown or widespread failure of current systems.
Charles, I've talked to people in medicine and education who've said that back in the 1980s, they could not have imagined that things could possibly go on for five more years, that it was reaching a breaking point. And despite one crisis after another, the response in each of these crises, where you could have let go, was to hold on even tighter. The same thing happened in 2008 with the financial crash. For example, there is another economic crash looming in the next, well, it could be any day, it could be in the next 2 or 3 years, but that won't necessarily force us to change. But it does offer us a moment of choice, an opportunity to change.
Or we could intensify the institutions of control that are necessary to maintain the continued hollowing out of the middle class, the continued stripping of social and natural wealth from the world. To maintain that requires upping the violence or control level, but we could change. It's an actual choice. We're not going to be forced into a more beautiful world. We have to choose it.
Felicity, do you sense that more people are ready to make that choice, and that they are ready to step into a life validated by meaning, so that we live meaningful, creative lives strengthened by the love you talk about? There are a lot of young politicians, for example, who are unashamedly calling for the expression of compassion, tolerance, respect, spirituality, the soul.
Charles: Yes, any activity which spreads the vibration of love and the experience of love and the experience of kindness. That's why this is important political work, because it changes the conditions from which we make this choice, and it tells people there is an alternative. Any experience of community, of generosity, where people are taking care of each other, any experience of our divine nature, says the world we've been offered as normal is unacceptable. And we do not have to choose that. On the other hand, invocations of compassion and so forth in politics, for instance, can fall into the category of the spiritual, as separate from the economic, the material, and so on. So it often means we're going to keep this world-destroying machine going, but within that we're going to be nicer to each other.
Felicity: Yes, we can use all sorts of wonderful words and ideas, but unless we actually make the changes so that people are not starving, then the real change simply doesn't happen.
Charles: The maldistribution of food follows the maldistribution of money, and that is baked into the financial cake. Because of the way that money is created in the system as interest-bearing debt. So that's fundamentally what has to change. We have to change the way that money is created and circulated.
Felicity: Of course, the men of money aren't going to give up very easily, are they?
Charles: Some of them will give it up. This is part of the choice and change that we are talking about. The choice that they will have to make mirrors the choice that we all have to make. There will be a sacrifice, that is the guardian at the threshold of the new world. In any true gift, there's always a sacrifice. You don't just take some superfluous stuff that you don't want or that you have attachment to. That's not the kind of gift that we need to make.
I think everyone in their lives faces this moment when your heart calls you to some kind of service, and there's a part of your brain that says, but will I be okay if I do that? Will I be irresponsible? Will I make it? There's a sacrifice of some kind of security. You know, as it says in the Bible, you can't serve two masters. Well, actually, you can serve two masters until you reach a clarifying moment when you get to choose which master you serve.
The men of money, as you call them, will be faced with the same choice that everybody else is facing. Every time you make the choice, that helps them make the choice too. For the world to change, they don't all have to choose a more beautiful world. They don't all have to choose to let go of the illusion of security and service to what their heart asks of them. But a lot of them do. Everyone will face a choice of which world do you want to live in.
Felicity: I'm wondering how it would be possible to bring together the band of activists around the world. How can we bring together the different areas of activism? I suppose you could call it a sort of alliance of people determined to serve this great life and each other. Is it possible to bring us all to a kind of alignment with others to make the changes we've been talking about?
Charles: People talk about online platforms, hubs, things like that to unite us. But I think that the uniting is happening already in ways far more subtle than anything we can devise in that way. What is helpful to me, and many people I speak to, is to articulate a larger story that we are all contributing to, and that gives meaning to contributions which might not otherwise make sense.
We need to recognize that we are all actually carrying out a role in the birth of a new story of civilization, the story of interbeing. And even if it may not look like your particular field of activism is related to my kind of activism, we are in fact working on the same thing. Many are following their hearts to provide our medicine to exactly the right spot it is needed. There is a coordinating power that operates through the heart, that directs us in ways we cannot understand. So we don't need to do that part of bringing activists together.
A unifying message is taking shape that helps us to recognise our allies in activism across vast distances. It also helps us to identify what isn't serving this common endeavour and what is contributing to it. It looks like there's so much despair and that those in power will never let go. And it seems as if things are getting worse and worse.
I'm familiar with all those narratives and all the evidence, and at the same time, I'm also encompassing data points, such as the woman on YouTube who is healed from a stage 4 cancer with multiple organ failure and in a coma. She had a spiritual experience and within days pulled all the tubes out and walked out of the hospital. That kind of stuff happens. Probably most people have things like that happen to them, like an anomalous healing, spiritual experiences, amazing synchronicities.
You could dismiss these things as coincidence, but if we're going to have an accurate operating system as agents of change in the world, we have to encompass all of this. You have to encompass the worst horror and the most beautiful sublime bliss.
And when I can encompass all of it, when I can embrace all of it, then I am much more able to understand that I and the human species have been born for some reason, that Gaia did not make some mistake in giving birth to humanity. There is an incomprehensible intelligence at work here on every level, from the species to the planetary, all the way down to the individual level.
For more information, visit charleseisenstein.org. And that's our program for today. If you have any questions or would like to know more about the World Teacher, Maitreya, and the Masters of Wisdom, please call us on 06-3646-101. That's 06-3646-101. Or visit the website share-international.org, where you'll find more information on the various aspects of the emergence.
To inquire about Share International magazine subscriptions, books by Benjamin Krem, or our monthly free of charge newsletter, which contains extracts from the current Share International magazine, the number is 04234-1133. That number again is 04234-1133, or write to P.O. Box 9576 Wellington.
Thank you for listening to us on Wellington's Access Radio 106.1 FM. And please tune in to our next World Teacher program on Saturday the 8th of July at the usual time of 10 a.m.
You can listen again to this program and previous ones by visiting our website at share-international-nz.info and click on the radio tab.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.